see many indicators that the North Koreans are about to make a hardline policy change.
What a ride on a white stallion might mean to U.S.-North Korean relations. This is Thursday, the 5th of December, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also ahead, the United States is falling behind other nations in the enrollment of foreign students. The U.S. speaks out again about what China has done or plans to do. And Australians take steps to teach about the didgeridoo. All of that and more on today's VOA Asia. North Korean media published new pictures of leader Kim Jong-un riding a white horse along a symbolic mountain Wednesday, which observers say suggests the regime is preparing to make a major policy announcement. The photos, published by the official KCNA news agency, showed Kim leading a large group of riders through a snow-covered forest near Mount Paektu. Kim made a similar trip to the mountain back in October. Since taking power in 2011, Kim has visited the mountain on several occasions, often before making key decisions, such as having his uncle executed in 2013. His previous visit came in December of 2017, just before Kim pivoted toward diplomacy with the United States and South Korea. Some officials in the North Korean government are quoted as saying that we might have a Christmas surprise for the United States. Joining us is Ankit Panda, an adjunct senior fellow in the Defense Posture Project at the Federation of American Scientists. Anki, what does this mean now? Should we take it at face value?
I think we see a number of indicators, not only this display at Mount Paektu with Kim Jong-un and his wife and many of his top deputies on horseback. We see many indicators that the North Koreans are about to make a hardline policy change. So, in fact, I would say that while these photographs do reiterate that message to the outside world, what we should also take note of is that the North Koreans have called somewhat remarkably for the convening of a new plenum of the Central Committee of the Workers' Party before the end of the year.
What has led to this, in your opinion?
Well, I think the North Koreans have grown quite frustrated with the United States. After the Hanoi summit in April this year, Kim Jong-un called on the United States at a party plenary meeting in April. He called on the United States to take a bold decision and change its negotiating posture towards North Korea, effectively for the United States to be willing to give North Korea sanctions relief in exchange for certain concessions on nuclear facilities that the United States had on offer in Hanoi. None of that has happened. Washington has not changed its diplomatic negotiating position. I think we also saw that at the failed working level talks that took place in Stockholm, Sweden in October. And both of these demonstrations of Kim Jong-un on horseback, I think, suggest that he is ready now to make a dramatic change in the national policy line. Also, you know, what I would note is that Kim Jong-un's own appearance in state media and state propaganda this year has been undergoing a bit of a transformation. My sense is that he is internally being elevated now to a level more commensurate with that of his father and his grandfather. In North Korean propaganda, Kim Jong-un has never quite been afforded the level of ideological prestige and centrality that his father and certainly his grandfather, the national founder, enjoy. Broadly speaking, many of these displays this year, including a series of number of authoritative articles in state media, have been quickly elevating his position within the political and ideological framework of the state.
Can this be almost a Tower of Babel when it comes to how people negotiate between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un?
I don't think so. I think at this point, many of these messages that are being sent are not for the benefit of the United States. I think the North Koreans have made their peace with the fact that the United States is not about to change its negotiating position. I think what they are now doing is making clear that when they do go down what Kim Jong-un, during his New Year's Day address in 2019, called a new way, when the North Koreans do go down a more hardline path in 2020, or possibly even earlier than 2020, the fault will lie at the feet of the United States. That's what many of these statements, including the statement on a Christmas gift to the United States, have been trying to make clear, that the North Koreans told Washington exactly what it would take for a deal to materialize, and Washington didn't take those steps, and now the North Koreans have no option but to take a more hardline path. That's again what I think many of these displays really mean for external audiences.
I know this is speculation, but you keep a very close eye on what happens in North Korea. What form might this Christmas gift or any other change in policy mean?
Nuclear testing, I think, is probably not where the North Koreans are going to go, mainly because we haven't seen any reconstitutive activity at the Punggye-ri nuclear test site, which they dismantled in May 2018, albeit in a unverified and reversible manner. ICBM launches, I think, are likely. They have done one late in the year before. They launched the Hwasong-15 in late November. So we do, again, have a precedent there. If they did choose to do that, it would put an end really to the facade of this diplomacy that's been going on and really open up, I think, a new era and very likely a new round of crisis with the United States.
You just called it a facade. Have you always thought that?
Pretty much. I mean, since the beginning of the diplomatic process, going back to, I believe, last March was when we had confirmation that Kim Jong-un would meet Donald Trump in some circumstance, I just never saw the fundamentals in this in the U.S.-North Korea relationship coalescing in a way that would allow for mutual understanding in any sort of a deal.
What about Donald Trump? He keeps saying that he is a friend of Kim Jong-un, and he likes him and he admires him. Where's he going with this?
It's very difficult to predict where the president is going to go. So I think we're starting to see the building blocks come into place for a new round of crisis between the United States and North Korea.
Ankit Panda is the adjunct senior fellow in the Defense Posture Project at the Federation of American Scientists. Thanks so much for your time and information. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now at voanews.com. The United States is set to formally restart peace talks with the Taliban insurgency nearly 3 months after President Trump abruptly suspended the year-long process aimed at finding a political settlement to the war in Afghanistan. South Korean actor Cha In-ha was found dead in his home Wednesday, the country's third young celebrity to die over the past 2 months amid growing debate about the intense social pressure artists are facing. The Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi said Wednesday that the recently passed U.S. Senate human rights bill on Hong Kong represents 100% interference in China's domestic affairs. And a typhoon that swept over the Philippines Tuesday killed at least 10 people. We continue on VOA Asia. The number of new international student enrollments in the United States has declined for a straight third year, according to the Institute for International Education. Experts say many foreign students feel less welcome, find it harder to secure a U.S. visa, and have more educational options around the globe, including in countries where tuition is cheaper than in the United States. Sahar Majid reports in this story, narrated by Kathleen Strzok.
America remains the top destination for international students. But a report by the Institute of International Education says new enrollments are down for a third straight year.
According to the latest Open Doors report, there are 1,095,000 international students in the United States. However, unfortunately, that means that the number of students here is basically flat in the most recent figures. And the new enrollments continue to decline. And that is a deep concern to international educators across the United States.
The State Department acknowledges that the United States is competing with other nations to attract young minds.
We know that international students also have more choices than ever before about where to pursue higher education.
Australia, New Zealand, and Canada have become increasingly popular with foreign students. Canada has increased its international enrollment by 15% by offering smoother pathways to study.
Having these students come to Canada is very much a component of our strategy to attract and retain high-skilled workers in Canada.
Cost is a major factor when international students make their choice, and it's expensive to study in America. The average cost at a four-year public university is $27,000 for out-of-state tuition each year. At private universities, it's $41,000, according to the U.S. Department of Education.
There are a number of reasons why we see declines in the number of international students coming to the U.S., and I think the first is cost. The cost of higher education in the United States continues to rise. And so we need to get that under control.
Experts say international students also face uncertainty over proposed changes in U.S. policies. Optional Practical Training, or OPT, allows graduates to train in the field they studied. That enables them to stay in the U.S. up to 36 months after graduation.
Many international educators think it's extremely important to support things like optional practical training, which is an integrated part of the education students receive in this country.
In addition to declines in the number of students from South Korea, Vietnam, Mexico, Spain, and Nigeria, the report found fewer students from countries with strained relations with the U.S. That includes Iran, Turkey, and Pakistan, which are majority Muslim nations.
The rhetoric around immigrants overall, but particularly those coming from the Muslim countries, has hardened.
It's really exciting to see just the contribution that international students and scholars have made around the United States, whether it's through research or other means. But I've found, in addition, that in my career, both when I served in government and when I've been a professor, that I've found that having partners who've actually studied in the United States is a real benefit. We'll find that we actually have many things in common, maybe experiences in common.
For Sahar Majid, Kathleen Strzok, VOA News, Washington.
Happening now in Asia, South Korea and China agreed to beef up diplomatic and cultural exchanges to completely normalize ties that soured over the deployment of U.S. anti-missile systems in 2017. South Korea's President Moon Jae-in is scheduled to visit China Thursday. Stay up to date with VOA. This is VOA Asia. We are happy you are with us. A bipartisan group of 25 senators wants the United States to take a closer look into China's corporate social credit system. A December 2nd letter sent to U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer, the group of lawmakers says the Chinese plan generates a grave concern for the threats it could pose to U.S. companies and workers. The full system is set to be placed into full effect next year using an algorithmic system that collects and then rates corporate data to grade both domestic and international firms on their compliance to roughly 300 state-determined rules. Companies with scores that fall below a certain threshold would face penalties, including restrictions on business licenses and procurement opportunities, higher tax rates, and even loss of market access. VOA China branch correspondent Adriana Zhang spoke with Jeff Moon, a former assistant U.S. trade representative for China affairs in the administration of U.S. President Barack Obama. She asked him if the concern of the U.S. senators was legitimate.
I do think it's legitimate. I think this is a very important issue. I think this legislation, this new social credit law, threatens to become a major obstacle to U.S.-China trade in the future, because it is extremely broad. It will affect all foreign businesses, and it has the potential to result in all kinds of sanctions that we can't yet predict. And I think it's especially important that the timing of this letter comes right now. This social credit system is supposed to be rolled out next year, so it is not yet finalized, and Chinese authorities are now trying to come up with the details. There are efforts at the national level, and there are a variety of local efforts as well. So this is the time to be able to shape the final product here. And as I said, I think that I think that there is legitimate concern about how this system will be used and the extent to which it could discriminate against foreign businesses.
So if the system is imposing on U.S. companies who are doing business in China, what could be the result or impact on them?
Well, there could be arbitrary adverse consequences. They could be not denied access to markets. There are potential all kinds of consequences. They could be denied unfavorable business terms. They could be denied government procurement opportunities. They could be denied the ability to get necessary licenses or approvals. China has long used a variety of informal processes within the government to disadvantage foreign companies. And this system seems to swallow all of those past practices and could become a major trade impediment in the future.
So what do you think the U.S. government should do?
I think, first of all, understand what this system is all about, what it's trying to do, what the terms are or what they could be. Try to engage the Chinese government on that. I think it's important to express concern about the possibility that this will be yet another mechanism to discriminate against foreign businesses. And I think that it's important for this to be raised as another important issue in the bilateral agenda. I'm not aware of this being raised at that level previously. This is not, as far as I know, a part of the trade war discussion. And yet, as we try to solve a variety of problems, this has the potential to be an enormous problem, so that in the next few years, the trade war may be all about this new social credit system and how it's being used against foreign companies. So this is a good time to understand more and to try to shape the final outcome so that it has a benign impact.
But what else should we know?
Well, I think China has in the past, as I said, used a variety of formal and informal mechanisms to disadvantage foreign firms. These have been from state media expressing disapproval of specific firms, or boycotts, or inspections, tax audits, all kinds of mechanisms that are out there. And I think this is yet another, and it'll be extremely concerning. Also, if you look at the letter, the congressmen are specifically also expressing concern about free speech. They are looking, I think, specifically at the recent NBA case and how that caused a great controversy as Americans spoke out about various issues. And I think that they are seeing this social credit system in that context and how that could play out in the future and the impact that could have on foreign companies.
VOA China branch correspondent Adriana Zhang spoke with Jeff Moon, a former assistant U.S. trade representative for China affairs in the administration of President Barack Obama. Coming your way, U.S. lawmakers have found yet another Chinese target. We'll tell you more in a moment. This is VOA Asia.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. With VOA Asia, also follow radio program hosts VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia, Hong Kong's government pledged 511 U.S. million U.S. dollars on Wednesday in new relief measures to help bolster an economy battered by months of protests that have eroded business confidence in the international financial hub. Visit VOA Asia Facebook every day for top stories and great features to see and share on VOA Asia. We continue now. The U.S. House of Representatives has overwhelmingly voted in favor of a bill that would aim to close mass detention camps for China's Uyghur Muslim community, as well as sanction Chinese officials involved in the detentions in that country's Xinjiang province.
We are sending a message to Beijing. America is watching, and we will not stand silent.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi spoke on Tuesday as the U.S. House of Representatives overwhelmingly approved a bill aimed at China's crackdown on its Muslim minority. The Uyghur Act of 2019 calls for the closure of mass detention camps in the province of Xinjiang. It would see sanctions imposed on a member of China's Politburo for the first time. The committee oversees China's Communist Party. The bill would also ban the export of surveillance technology to China. If passed, it will require the Trump administration to toughen its response to China's treatment of its Uyghur minority. Republican Congressman Chris Smith condemned Beijing's treatment of the community.
Children ripped from the warm embrace of their families to be indoctrinated in communist ideology and forced to renounce their religious culture and language. Rape, sexual abuse, and forced abortions of women being held in internment camps. Forced labor on a scale that allows Chinese companies to profit from modern-day slavery.
UN experts say as many as 1 million people are being held in the camps. But China has repeatedly denied mistreatment of its Uyghur population, saying that the camps are meant to provide vocational training. In a statement on Wednesday, China's foreign ministry called the bill a malicious attack. The revised bill will now need to be approved by the Republican-controlled Senate before being sent to Trump. The White House did not respond to requests for comment.
That was Reuters reporter Jason Albano. Another news break from VOA Asia. South Korean actor Cha In-ha was found dead in his home, police said Wednesday. The country's third young celebrity to die over the past 2 months as concern mounted over the intense social pressures that artists face. Visit VOA Asia on YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter. You're listening to VOA Asia. A new exhibition is promising to enlighten and change the way Australians consider their nation's most iconic musical instrument. The didgeridoo, also known as the udaki, has immense cultural and spiritual importance. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has more.
The didgeridoo is the sound of Australia. The fabled instrument dates back 1,000 years to Arnhem Land in the Northern Territory. It tells stories of ancient ancestors and is the living breath of indigenous traditions. Aboriginal elders have helped to bring together a new interactive exhibition at the Queensland Museum in Brisbane. It gives visitors the chance to gain a fresh insight into the famous wind instrument and what it means to many First Nation peoples. The Queensland Museum Chief Executive is Jim Thompson.
As you step inside the exhibition, you'll also hear and feel the sounds of the instruments. It's a very immersive experience, and be transported to Arnhem Land, home of the Yolngu people and Yidiki master Jalu Gurawiri. For Jalu and the Yolngu people, the didgeridoo are udaki. They are not just musical instruments, they are social instruments, instruments of healing and spiritual life. This exhibition brings to life these instruments in an environment of sound, story, moving images and treasured objects, and tells the story from the creation of the instrument through its role in ceremony, diplomacy and everyday life.
The rich, full tones of a didgeridoo appear to evoke the breadth of the land itself. It's a long wooden tube that usually plays only one note, but is capable of a spectacular range of different sounds. It's the rhythmic variation of these sounds that makes the instrument so mesmeric. No two didgeridoos produce the same sound. Their length, diameter and the texture of the wood all affect the tone and pitch of the instrument. The distinctive drone and hypnotic pattern is created by circular breathing. Experts can also mimic the sounds of the natural world, including the swirling movement of a snake or the howling pitch of the wind. Most didgeridoos are made for the souvenir market. The display at the Queensland Museum runs until March 2020. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers using the National Science Foundation's Green Bank Radio Telescope say they discovered a neutron star that is the most massive ever detected. The researchers found that this neutron star packs a mass 2.17 times that of our Sun into a sphere that's a mere 30 kilometers in diameter. According to the researchers, this newly discovered neutron star is so heavy that if it had just a little more mass, it could have instead formed a black hole. Neutron stars are composed of the highly compressed remains of a giant star that exploded in a Type II supernova. This new discovery is also considered a pulsar, since observers here on Earth can detect the powerful beams of energy they emit from their magnetic poles. This neutron star spins so quickly that it would only take a couple of milliseconds for a full rotation. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. Remember to get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud, download our podcast, and take VOA Asia with you. Visit our voanews.com program page. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Zimab Abdelrahman, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and the VOA Asia team of Jim Stevenson, Keith Lane, Doug Bernard, and our interns, Hai Yang and Candace. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a wonderful day ahead.